Fantasy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. And boy, oh boy, do I have a big story behind the book today. And I am so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper, welcome back, because she's been here before, and we always get to talk about something that is one of my favorite subjects, Roman history. Hi, Brooke Allen. Are you there?
I sure am, Patsy. It's good to hear your voice.
Oh, Brooke, it's so nice to talk to you. Of course, you know, whenever March comes along and Ides of March comes along, I'm thinking about you. So, oh boy. You know, it's just so exciting. And I remember when you started, I actually remember when you started this trilogy about Mark Antony. And, of course, you'll tell us all about the three books that you... Well, this is exciting, isn't it?
It is. I tell you what, it just doesn't get tiresome at all. Being an author is the most awesome thing ever.
Well, I remember when Margaret George showed me the manuscript, a big, thick thing of paper, you know, and I said, oh, and she said, I've been reading this, and it is so great. You're going to love it. And boy, oh, boy, it was Margaret George Wright, and she knows history. So,
anyway, she is a gem.
She is.
She is a gem, I tell you. There's just nobody better.
So to get... compliments from her, to get people to, just love your trilogy. I think it's so fantastic. I think it's so wonderful. Just let's talk about how you started this.
Sure. You know, believe it or not, this project began literally back when I was in high school, because I had a fantastic sophomore English teacher, and she introduced us to Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. And right then and there, I knew I needed to write about the ancient Roman Republic. And it was just a matter of knowing exactly what I needed to write on. And I, for the longest time, Patsy, I just didn't feel like I had the life lessons to do this book. And so I finally went and got my master's with an emphasis in Roman history and Roman studies, and that's when I started it. And I decided on Mark Antony because he had the military background, he had aspects, and just an all total, just a really adventurous life. And I knew that would really be a standout. So I thought he was a good choice.
Well, he was. Certainly, if you want a project where you're going to have lots of opportunity to do research, you picked the right one.
I sure did. And, you know, it led me to a lot of travel. I've been to Rome 6 or 7 times, went to Egypt, even before the final regime fell, before the revolution in 2010. I went to Turkey and even Greece, all over Greece, even to where the site of the Battle of Actium was. Of course, that's where Antony and Cleopatra lost really big. But it was a really remote site. It was actually hard to get somebody to even give me a tour.
I know. And the guy, I've been there.
Have you? Yeah. It's such a repressed part of the country. You know, you just don't hear much about Western Greece. Everything's in the east and the islands. And I fell in love with Greece. It was just such a lovely place, and the people there are so warm. And, of course, the food is incredible.
Anyway,
yeah, the Mediterranean is still probably my favorite place on Earth.
Well,
I just love it.
You know, my husband and I, my first honeymoon was, we did the Appian Way.
Mm-hmm.
That was our first honeymoon. You know, I was married 3 times. I think I told you. But I married the same guy 3 times. But I said, if we're going to get married, we need to have a honeymoon each time.
You know, right.
Yeah.
Hey,
so
don't leave the fun part out.
That's right. So we had the Appian Way was the first one. And this was such a wonderful opportunity for me, you know, loving. I mean, I studied Latin for 4 years, you know, so I had that joy of translating, you know, Caesar's Gallic Wars when I was very young. And so I was ready for that trip. I could tell you, So, I, my husband could not believe it. He could be, because we hadn't been married. We hadn't actually known each other very long. And when he discovered that I'm taking him on a trip, you know, that I could tell him every place. And he quickly learned that I could take him to every battlefield. And that actually became our thing. I could get him to take me anywhere if I said there's a battlefield, you know. So we did that trip. And, of course, when we got to Brindisi, we took a ferry boat across with our car. We were driving, by the way, a white Cadillac, which was sort of our wedding present, joint wedding present. And we had taken it all the way from America over to Germany, drove down Germany, and then did the Appian Way. And, of course, once we got into Greece with a white Cadillac, and you know the roads there.
Oh, yeah, and the gateways. I'm surprised you didn't get stuck.
Well, we had some, I can tell you, we had some hairy times, and particularly on some of those roads, because, you know, they're very, very narrow. Mm-hmm. And they have all of these crosses, all these little shrines along the way where people have gone off. And, and here we are in this gigantic white Cadillac. The funniest thing, of course, the first thing we discovered, you know, they didn't have electric pumps. So we had to pump the petrol into the car, you know, with a hand pump.
Oh, my.
Now, do you know how hard it is to fill a white Cadillac?
Oh, my gosh. That would have taken, that would have been a pain.
Oh, that was so funny. That was so funny until we got to a city. But that was our first petrol station when we got into Greece was a hand pump. The owners, I mean, I think the entire village came out to watch us do that.
Oh my!
It was lots of fun, and of course,
when I was there, it was back in 2015, and that was right when their economy was about to crash. And I was there on the day before the deadline, you know, of the banks, you know, closing and all this kind of stuff. So, man, I had to get some money out, you know, just so that I would be covered in case my flight was delayed or anything like that. It was pretty crazy.
Well, of course, it was good that you got there before it got really, really bad.
Yeah, absolutely.
So
they're such an amazing people. The Greek people are so warm, so kind, and so resilient. You know, they've had so much trauma in their long history, and they always bounce back, and they're always like cats. They land on their feet, you know.
They do, and you're right. Well, the combination of the lovely people, the ouzo, and the food, I mean, what can you say? It's a wonderful place to go.
It really is. It really is. And, you know, I'm hoping that perhaps the British government will give back or loan back the, you know, Elgin marbles, because they've got a brand new museum that was built, and it's so spectacular. I don't know if you've been back since it was built, but it's phenomenal.
No, I haven't. I haven't. Not in recent years. But again, the wonderful thing is when you get an idea for a book, when, you know, what was the actual moment when you said, I'm going to do a book about Mark Antony. I'm going to start when he's a kid, and I'm going to take him right through, you know, his entire life.
Okay. Wow. It's, you know, first of all, it's kind of scary because, you know, nobody knows who I am. Am I going to be able to do this and do it well? So, first of all, of course, I had to decide I was going to do him. Julius Caesar had been done so many times, as had Cleopatra. Robert Harris had just done his amazing trilogy on Cicero, and so I kept coming back to Antony. He is very controversial, and because of that, I thought, you know, that's actually another plus for him in doing a huge biographical historical fiction work. So I just dived right in, and Margaret George was an inspiration because at one point in her novel, The Memoirs of Cleopatra, she mentioned how Antony was telling Cleopatra about how his dad died when he was 11 years old. And I thought, wow, what a perfect place to start my novel. The moment he finds out his father has died, and in such a shameful way, we don't know exactly how Creticus died or was killed, but we do know that it happened in a period where he had failed miserably at his mission, which was to eradicate piracy in the Mediterranean near Greece. So, you know, he was given the name Creticus not because he died near Crete. It was because he was a man of chalk, easily erased from history. And the first book takes place from when he's 11 years old until he's about 27 when he meets Cleopatra for the very first time. She is a princess of the blood in Egypt. Her father is still on the throne, and Antony has recently helped restore him to the throne with the power of Aulus Gabinius and the Roman Senate at his back. So that's the first book. The second book takes off from there. And watches Antony as he kind of ascends to power at the side of Julius Caesar. And it ends at the Battle of Philippi when he defeats Brutus and Cassius after Caesar's assassination. And, of course, then the final book covers all of the romance between Antony and Cleopatra and the drama after that as civil war in Rome begins again. And, you know, the aftermath, which we all know the outcome, unfortunately.
And now, this series, three books, people can buy it as a trilogy, all three books together?
They can. It's available at Amazon. It's available through Barnes & Noble. It's on ebook as well as, you know, print copy. And I'm kind of striving towards getting an audiobook made one of these days. I'd really love to do that.
Oh, I think it will be a terrific audiobook. Absolutely.
I think so. You know, if I find the right voice, you know, I just think that it'd be really wonderful. You know, the thing about writing and being an independent author is that I do control everything, and that's a nice thing in a way because, you know, I get full benefit from that financially. And it's such a crazy industry, you know, you do have two different ways, methods of publishing, and that is traditional through an agent and a publisher versus independent publishing, which is simply going out and publishing your book yourself. And that's the method I used for the Antonius trilogy. And so I've got another work in progress right now that I'm hoping to wrap up this summer, and we'll see where that takes me. I'm not sure yet.
Well, of course, the first book is called Antonius, Son of Rome, and mm-hmm. I think that was published the Ides of March. That was back in 2019, right?
Actually, yes, it was.
Yep.
And I can't believe it's 4 years old. It's past toddler stage. Isn't that incredible?
It is. I mean, it seems like yesterday that we were talking about the book and you were here, you know, and we were on the radio. We're, you know, talking away about Antonia. And just what a fantastic subject. And I was thinking, it was so funny. You know, when an author sometimes one little word, one little idea will click in your brain, and it's sort of, I compare it to having a bee in your bonnet. You get this idea, and most people don't know that term really comes from Virgil, from the Aeneid.
So that's right.
He got this idea. Yeah, and you know, you have this idea, and it can get so compelling that once you start, as you said, you start the research a little bit here, a little bit there. Then you say, well, I make a trip here. I could do this. I could do that. Doesn't it fill your life? Can you now imagine your life without Mark Antony?
I can't. And, you know, I have a really loving husband who really was supportive, even though I had this other man in my life for, you know, 15 years. He was wonderfully supportive, and especially with the travel. Towards the end, when I was working on the final two books, second in command and soldier of fate. Carlton actually accompanied me over to both Greece and Italy for some of my research, and that was such a joy to be able to include him in it in some way. That was great.
That's wonderful, because it fills your life. It just I explain to people sometimes that, you know, if you have this idea, whether it might be a idea about a family relative, you know, somebody, you know, a great grandfather who was in a battle, and then you decide, I'm going to write a book about him. And then suddenly you have to start doing this research. You have to start reaching out to relatives that you maybe haven't spoken to for years. And it just grows and it grows, and it becomes so much a part of your life that after you get to the point where your books are published and you're looking at it and you say, this was destiny. It was, we say in Yiddish, beshert. It was meant to be. Somehow, Mark Antony was in your heart and soul, and you didn't even know it.
That's exactly right. And to have somebody like Margaret George come alongside me and say, hey, I will support you, has just been incredible. She has been an amazing mentor. She has been an amazing support. My editor kept begging me, you know, you've made this friendship, this relationship. I said, yes, I've made this friendship, but I don't want it to come across that I'm using her, you know. And my editor said, oh, just ask her. See if she'll blurb your first book, because it would really help give you such a boost. And so finally I did. I just broke down and asked Margaret. I sent her an email. And literally, Patsy, within 30 minutes, she responded and said, yes, 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 I want to do this for you. The only problem was I've been planning to publish in February, and she was going to be out of town, out of the country. She says, if there's any way you can wait. I said, I'll wait. And I said, I'll ship the manuscript to you, a hard copy, so you don't have to fumble online for it and everything. So that's what I did. And at that point, I had to determine, when am I going to publish? When am I going to publish? And my husband sat down and said, oh, I've got this figured out. It's got to be the Ides of March.
Exactly.
And I thought, you know, that's really cool. I think you've got something here.
Yeah.
So that's exactly what I did.
Well, it was so funny. I went, you know, to visit Margaret, and it was, she made me this wonderful, wonderful English tea. We had an English tea party in her sunroom. It was wintertime, and we were all cozy, and we're having tea, and she made a proper British tea with cucumber sandwiches and salmon sandwiches.
Oh my.
It was gorgeous. And we're sitting in and then she disappears for a little while. She, you know, we're eating, and then she goes away for a little while. She comes back with, and she's holding this manuscript, and she said, I just read this wonderful manuscript. And so then we get into this long conversation, and she was so thrilled with it. So our tea party turned into a whole talk about Brooke Allen and this wonderful book. Because if anyone has bees in her bonnet, it's Margaret George. And when she got them, you know, I can imagine what happened when she got the first idea for Henry VIII. And now this was a bee in her bonnet. And then she got the brilliant idea of writing it as an autobiography of Henry VIII. Nobody had ever done that. You know, there's lots of histories of Henry VIII, and this, you know, some of them are interesting, some of them are boring. But boy, when she decided to write it as an autobiography, Henry telling his story, now that was something special.
Coming straight from the king. Absolutely.
I remember when I read that book. I remember when I have been her fan forever, I think from her very first book. But I remember particularly when I got Henry VIII, the autobiography of Henry VIII, I just sat there and I said, oh, wow, this is so smart.
Yeah. You know, in American historical fiction, as far as authors are concerned, she is truly the grand dame of historical fiction in our time as Americans. And I just have to say, Patsy, that, you know, I was floored. You know, I had no idea this woman had such a humble, kind, loving spirit, and that's exactly what she has. And she has proven it time and again. I remember we were at the Portland, Oregon Historical Novel Society conference about 7 years ago, and I was working on my second book in the series, and I said, you know, if you did the first book as far as a blurb, who would you suggest? You know, who do you think I should approach? And she says, I've got something in mind, and she said, you'll hear from me. And literally within about 3 days, I'd just gotten back from the conference. I got this amazing email from Margaret, and she said, you know, I want to tell you that I've given your name to Michelle Moran. Here's her email. Contact her. She wants to read your, you know, manuscript. So Michelle Moran, another best-selling author, you know, blurbed for me on my second book, was kind enough to do that. And, you know, just this amazing harmony of authors. When I say harmony, because everybody works together. Everybody is right on pitch. Everybody is helping one another. And it doesn't matter so much anymore if you're independent or if you are traditional. People are there to help you, and it just blows me away. I think that's the most powerful takeaway I've had through this whole process of being an author, is how supportive people can be.
Oh, it's true. Absolutely. And of course, with Margaret, it was so wonderful. I was at her house, and it's wintertime, and she's showing me a lot of things. She goes behind the couch and she says, do you want to see? And I knew who she was getting. She was getting her tortoise. She has like this unbelievable ancient tortoise, I think 50 years old, maybe 60.
Yeah.
And she wrote a lovely book, a children's book called Lucille Lost, about a tortoise. And so it was so thrilled. I got a selfie with a tortoise. That's, you know, that's pretty spectacular.
Well, her daughter, or her granddaughter, she wrote a book with her granddaughter recently also. And, you know, I think it was not about a tortoise. I think she'd hoped it was going to be about a tortoise, but it turned out to be, I think, a platypus that they wrote about. So I just love, you know, she's just a lady full of imagination, and that's amazing, you know. Imaginations are the most wonderful things we all own as human beings, and as an educator, I always challenge students, use your imagination here.
And,
you know, don't rely on video stuff.
And although they're talking about AI writing books, it is still the human experience. It's what we get in our minds. It's what we get from our travels, what we get from knowing people that makes a difference. So I don't believe AI is ever going to write a Jane Eyre or a Margaret George book or one of your books, because there's so much heart, there's so much love, there's so much more than just words.
Exactly. And you know, that's what a book should be. That's what a book should be. From the Bible all the way to Memoirs of Cleopatra or any of the other great books, you know, Jane Eyre.
Oh my gosh.
Moby Dick, you know, whether it's violence, whether it's heartfelt love, romance, whether it's adventure. Oh my gosh, I just got turned on to Wilbur Smith's novels. I don't know if you've ever read Wilbur Smith, but he's an incredible writer, was, unfortunately, passed on now. And Sharon K. Penman. I literally had to put the book down aside to just catch my breath at some of her adventure, you know, battle scenes. They were just incredible. So intense. But yeah, I don't see how AI can possibly catch the emotion of a book and really do it justice in comparison to a warm-blooded writer, you know?
Exactly, exactly. Well, you know, Brooke Allen, I'm so happy that you were on Joy on Paper today. It's always a joy to talk to you. You have a website. I think it's, what is it?
It's brookeallenauthor.com.
And Brooke is spelled with no E.
With no E, yeah.
Yeah.
Just Brooke.
Just like a babbling Brooke. That's
right.
That's how we can remember you. Again, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. People, this is a wonderful, wonderful trilogy. It will take you on these magical trips all across from Rome over to Egypt. Well, it, you know, what can we say? When I get involved in a book, when I fall in love with a subject, I know how it happened to you and how you put that into your series. So everybody, please check out Brooke Allen and check out her trilogy about Mark Antony, as you know him, Marcus Aurelius, and again, Marcus Aurelius. Did I say that? Oh, well, you know, I'm thinking.
Mention the name. Yeah,
give the three names again.
The first book is Antonius, Son of Rome. The second, Antonius, second in command, and the third, Antonius, soldier of fate.
Okay. Well, everybody, again, Brooke Allen, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper, and you can babble away with me whenever you want, okay? You take care now.
It's a pleasure, Sandy.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Okay, Big Ed in the control room. I'm not going to do commercials today because it's a special day, and I we'll just do the book buzz, and then I'm waiting for something weird. I mean, a really weird author right after this book buzz from Bria Burton.
Hello, fellow sci-fi readers. This is author Bria Burton reporting for Joy on Paper with your science fiction book buzz. Today's communique to galaxies near and far includes an L. Ron Hubbard's Writers of the Future semi-finalist released in 2021, Awakened by T.E. Bradford, available in print and ebook. Now, let's download the book buzz. In a bleak world where manufactured anodic commandos, or Macs, mercilessly hunt and kill humans, a wounded resistance fighter named Kara comes face to face with one of these machines. If her injury doesn't kill her, this Terminator will. But the Mac has a wound of his own and has short-circuited. Stuck on the wrong side of the wall, distant drones approach, sealing her death sentence. A wild idea convinces her to try and rewire the Mac. Maybe she's wrong, but she's dead either way. The gamble pays off, and he's activated again, carrying her out of danger to a safe location. But the rewiring did more than just a factory reset. He's behaving strangely, offering sympathy, doctoring her wound, and explaining things that shouldn't be possible about the war being fought over her now desolate homeland. Her hatred for these machines wavers in light of the unbelievable change. The journey back to her base through enemy territory won't be possible without him. With each passing hour, the test of whether he'll remain a friend or revert back to foe creates a delicate dance between human and machine. This high-tension, compact novella offers emotional punches right alongside the action, all while infusing themes of truth and spiritual meaning all the way to its climactic ending. Author T.E. Bradford is a writer, singer, songwriter, and cancer survivor. In her heart, she feels that her gift of writing is a little piece of magic, and that it is both her privilege and grandest adventure to find new ways to stretch a hand out to touch the wonder of this vast universe God created. This is Bria Burton with your futuristic fiction fix, signing off.
Hi. Okay, I am back, and I'm so happy to welcome somebody who, well, I don't know. We're not going to say he's weird, but he certainly knows a lot about weird. And it is a Nat Geo book, and I want to say gift season is coming up, and we have Easter, Mother's Day, Father's Day, graduations, and then, of course, the biggest gift day of all, which is every day if you have a kid in your life. So I want everybody, if you have a kid in your life, I have the perfect gift for you to give them. It is called Weird But True, Know It All, The Middle Ages. And it is by Michael Bergen. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Patsy. How are you?
Okay. Oh, I love this book. I love this book. I'm history crazy, and Middle Ages I love, and then, oh, this one is so fantastic. It's just filled with everything.
Well, thank you for saying that.
So, of course, to be working for Nat Geo is in a way to be playing for Nat Geo because it's so much fun.
You're right. I mean, I feel very fortunate to be able to do these books for them. This is the second one, and I'm actually working on the third right now.
Well, they are, their books are always so wonderful. And, of course, the fact that you get to do one that's called Weird Weird Things.
Yeah, I was going to say, you can say that I'm weird, too. That's I won't be offended.
Okay, well, perhaps members of your family have occasionally suggested that, right?
Yes.
And but well, what's better than that? I mean, you of course you're a great writer. You've written some historical children's books, right?
I've written a lot of history for kids, a lot of biographies, great empires, presidents. You name it. I've probably written about it.
I know you read you wrote the Teddy Roosevelt one because I got that for a kid.
Oh, great.
Again, Teddy Roosevelt is one of my favorite characters, so I read anything. I'll read a comic book about him. So, how did you know a lot about the Middle Ages when you started this book?
I did not. You know, I was a history major in college, and I did take one course in the Middle Ages decades ago, but, you know, that was really focused on Europe, and with this book, we really wanted to make it a global look at that time period of the Middle Ages. So I learned a lot about empires in Asia and the Americas and Africa that I knew nothing about before.
Well, of course, and you're right. It used to be that Middle Ages were, you know, what was going on in Europe, because what was going on in Europe might not have been the Middle Ages for other civilizations because they were advanced.
That's right. I mean, we sometimes call it the Dark Ages in reference to Europe, but I think when you look at the world as a whole, that's certainly not true with all the great learning and inventions that were going on in the Islamic nations and in China, particularly.
And they were at their peak over there in China.
Yes, that's right.
And what I loved Timbuktu. Don't remember.
Oh, right.
When I was a kid, I don't know why we used to say we're going to Timbuktu. I think in those days when kids ran away from home, they'd say, I'm going to Timbuktu. Or
same thing for me. I remember that as a kid. It was always kind of like this. You didn't even know if it was a real place. It was just always kind of thrown out there. But then you see what great empire they had that was centered there.
Yeah, you know, thinking about it, I'm not sure if it was the kids who said we were going to Timbuktu or if the parents were saying we're going to send you to Timbuktu.
Right.
But I mean, that word is so much part of my childhood. And to know there was a heck of a university there, that would have been a nice place to send us.
That's right. I think it was about 25,000 students at one point.
Yeah.
And the whole empire was, you know, was built on gold. And I know that when one of the big kings went to Mecca for a pilgrimage, he brought like a ton of gold with him to kind of show off his wealth.
Yeah, so maybe we should have been sent to Timbuktu. We'd have come back with gold.
That's right.
Oh, there's just so much. I knew a lot about Middle Ages in Europe because I've done a lot of study in that era. And because I lived in England, I traveled to so many places in England that were very relevant in the Middle Ages. So, of course, I knew a lot. But as you said, and the same with Paris, because I went to Paris a lot, so I knew about Notre Dame and, you know, and all of that. Tell us, what are some of the fun things that you discovered that really surprised you?
Well, there's a couple that I really enjoyed. One was about animals being put on trial. If a farm animal got out and damaged property or hurt a person, they were actually put on trial, which I thought was kind of unusual, and that kids might get quite a visual image of seeing a horse or a pig sitting in the courtroom being tried.
I can tell you about that one. If my grandfather had a choice, he would have put my grandmother's goat on trial because that goat hated him. And now, she kept him tied up next to the porch, And so she'd sit there on the porch in a rocking chair shelling peas, and her goat was very happy to be with her. But when he'd get loose, he'd chase my grandfather. And and sometimes right up a tree, literally, he would...
Oh, boy.
Yeah, he would have had that goat arrested so fast.
That's funny. The other one anecdote I really like is about a Danish king named Harald, who ruled in like 9th or 10th century. He was known for unifying different Danish tribes and kind of forming the first Danish nation. And he was also known for having one diseased tooth that was kind of bluish black. And so he picked up the nickname Harald Bluetooth. And then centuries later, an engineer was working on a project to connect electronic devices wirelessly, phones and laptops and all that. And he read about Harald, and he said he was going to name his new technology Bluetooth. So when out today, when we use Bluetooth on our phones or other devices, we can thank Harald for the name.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, that's one I didn't know. So that I thought that was fantastic. And there's something else now, actually, that would be quite relevant in today's San Francisco. They had something called, in the Middle Ages, they had something called pattens, which were...
Yes.
Wooden lifts that you put on the bottom of your shoes for obvious reasons, because the streets weren't clean. So I think
that's right.
Actually, we might, you know, you and I could get together a joint venture, and we could start selling these in San Francisco, because I understand it's not so nice to walk over there.
Oh, I didn't know that. But yeah, those were very practical devices when a time when you didn't have much sanitation or any sanitation. People just dumped their waste in the streets. So the pattens definitely kept you a little cleaner.
So when you were doing this research, I mean, did you actually get to go and, you know, visit some museums, look at their collections of some of the artifacts they had?
I wish. Unfortunately, the time frame for these books is very tight, and there's so much material to cover that I usually rely mostly on books and scholarly articles, and then online. You know, there are a lot of good sources for museums and their collections, so that was very helpful. But it would be ideal to be able to go to some of these countries and see these things in person, but there was no budget for that.
Well, you know, they have to send you on a book signing tour to some of these places.
That would be nice, too. Yes.
Yeah, I'm going to suggest it to the higher-ups over there at Nat Geo.
Very good.
Because I always have a lot of suggestions for them, including...
You probably have more clout than me, too.
Well, you know, I have. I always tell when I talk to anybody over there in the upper echelons that they have to make November... Nat Geo month, because that is a month that I always recommend to people that they get a Nat Geo book when they go to Thanksgiving Day. and bring along a Nat Geo book, because that is the mm-hmm. best gift. A Nat Geo book for any age is actually the best gift, because the one thing I learned in 20 years of bargain hunting at garage sales is that you will never find a Nat Geo book at a garage sale. People will sell everything, but Nat Geo books are treasures.
That's nice to know. It's nice to know that these books will be saved and enjoyed for decades. I like that idea.
Well, I mean, look at this book that you've created here. First of all, the quality is fantastic. Lovely. It just feels so good. The paper is so good. The research is extraordinary. The photographs are fantastic. Your stories are also fascinating. People will be reading these. I have my dad's, the National Geographic magazines that we got. Mm-hmm. My dad started getting them, I think, in 1953. And I still have a lot of those magazines. Because I love them, and they don't, you know, they're timeless.
Right. And I think, you know, one of the beautiful things about National Geographic is that they're, as you mentioned, the photography, I mean, the images in general, the artwork, they're just so colorful and just draw you in. And I think that was one thing that, you know, writing for kids, it's having those engaging visuals really helps to get their attention.
And the maps and the questions.
Yes.
All of that. The illustrations are particularly good in this one. I mean, getting all the character faces, looking at Charlemagne and looking at, you know, I just got a kick out of everybody. The Vikings, I love the Viking ones.
Well, and I think, you know, obviously these are geared for kids, but I would like to think that there's enough in there to keep adults entertained and hopefully educate them a little bit, too.
Oh, definitely. I mean, this is the kind, when we talk about, you know, a coffee table book, this is the kind of book that you want right there on your coffee table as you're watching television and they're talking about something. They're talking about a place. You just pick it up and you look. They're talking about India. Look up India here. They're talking about, you know, something. They can find it in here. And it just adds to that whole knowledge base.
Yes, and I think, you know, again, to try to appeal for kids, we try to keep the text, you know, in big chunks that are individual topics. And I think, as you're saying, you could just kind of pick it up and flip through, and on any page there's a little tidbit that's going to catch your eye and hopefully will be entertaining.
And hopefully people will have, actually, I hate to say this, I don't know if this is possible, but you could actually have conversations with other people about what you've learned.
Yes, yes, that would be nice.
I mean, wouldn't that be nice? Actually, when you get together and you have something to talk about, you can actually say, you know, put down your cell phone, for goodness sakes. I'm going to tell you what they were eating in the Middle Ages, and you won't believe it. Right?
Right, yes. And, well, speaking of eating, this is another one of the facts that I really enjoyed about King Henry III. He had a dinner, and I don't know who he was entertaining, how many people were there, but there was a record that he served 70,000 fish and 70,000 loaves of bread. So that must have been quite a meal.
Yeah, well, exactly. This is what is so much fun about this. And I love the, you know, when you have all these little sort of blurby things and the maps are excellent.
Yeah, well, you'd expect that from National Geographic, and you know, I don't see the maps until, you know, for probably late in the process, but I'm always really pleased to see how they've come up with what they come up with and how they take my few ideas, words and translate it into that great image.
And, of course, one of the important things here, of course, a trip to the fair. Nowadays, you know, we're used to fairs and we're used to going to amusement parks, and people might not realize that they were having amusements back then.
Right. I mean, you know, there would be, what was the one that I saw? It was about, there was the wrestling matches, and the winner would walk away with a ram. So that was a very practical gift, prize, I'm sure, at that time. And then you had entertainment for the jousts, you know, and there was always music and jesters and things like that. So, yeah, there was lots to do to entertain yourself. Although, of course, they didn't have something in their pocket like we do with our phones, but people came together and did things together for entertainment. So that's kind of nice.
And I just want to remind everybody, this is for my listeners, because Lee Child and his brother Andrew Child have been on Joy on Paper many times, and of course they write the Jack Reacher books, and the new Reacher series is starting, and I want them to know when they're watching Reacher that both of the boys went to schools that were started in the Middle Ages.
Wow.
Yeah. Andrew Child went to St. Albans, which was started, I think, in 987.
Mm.
And I mean, and I've been to that school many times. I've visited many times, and it is so. It was certainly one of the oldest schools in the world. Mm-hmm. And you know, when you go to these schools and you see they started in the Middle Ages, and they're still going strong.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's great.
Well, you know, I want to thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. And the name of the book is Weird But True, Know It All, The Middle Ages by Michael Bergen. Of course, everybody, if you have not gone to Nat Geo Kids website, you really must. It is a fantastic website. There are games, there are stories, there are videos. So it's a wonderful place to go. And Michael, I think you're a great writer. You really
put this together.
And I want to again tell people, you have a website to promote your children's book because you write great.
Oh, thank you. I do have a website. It's michaelbergen.net, and that's B-U-R-G-A-N.
Okay. People go there because, I can highly recommend all of his stories about historical characters because I love Teddy Roosevelt. So, again,
thank you
so much for being on Joy on Paper. I know that you work for Nat Geo, but I know also that you're having a lot of fun.
That's true. I'm very lucky to do what I do.
Okay, are you announcing what the next book is?
It'll be on government, all levels of U.S. government, from the federal down to the local. That'll have some weird stuff, right?
Okay. Now, that's going to be the weirdest of all. Anyway, it was fantastic talking to you, Michael.
Great. Thanks.
Okay.
Same here.
Thank you.
Thanks again.
Bye. And everyone, please, if you don't have a child in your life, get this book and send it to a kid in a hospital. Kid, we'll have so much fun, hours and hours of fun, your local children's hospital or Shriners or St. Jude. The kids need books. Please, please send them this. All you have to do is go online. It takes a minute, and the price is ridiculous. It's for the quality of this book, and this book really will last 100 years because it is top quality printing. Anyway, everybody, always, a Nat Geo book is the perfect gift, and I hope that if you're having a wedding this spring, you will turn a Nat Geo book into a yearbook for the wedding. Okay, well, that's been an exciting two authors I get to talk to. Well, that's what I love. As everyone knows, we just celebrated the 8th anniversary of Joy on Paper. It was lots of fun. Again, thank you everybody for the kind emails and cards and gifts and even flowers. And thank you so much. Thank you all so much. It means a great deal to me. It's been a wonderful, wonderful 8 years, and I'm just looking forward to I have so many authors. Big Ed just came out to the Big Ed was absolutely delightful today. He actually carried a load of books out to my car for me. Thank you, Ed. Thank you so much for that. That was so wonderful because I'm getting so many. Everybody wants to be on the program. So it's just wonderful. I want to thank everybody. But I want to end today's program with something very special, a song that means a great deal to me. And it's a song that my son played. And I just want to play it, and I hope you'll all take a few minutes to, while you're listening, to think about your loved ones and stay in contact.